Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There was a shocking scene in Minnesota yesterday. I'm sure you've heard about it. People were peaceful and kneeling on the ground, and then a semi-truck started driving right through the crowd. This happened on Interstate 35W, a bridge across the Mississippi River. Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz has said this is well beyond George Floyd. And when I checked in yesterday with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, before today's conversation, he said exactly the same thing. Ken is joining us from the Washington, D.C. area, which has now had 3 days of protests itself. Hi, Ken. I'm glad you could join us today.
Thank you for having me, Beth.
I thought this conversation was going to focus on COVID-19 and the pandemic, but a week ago, when Derek Chauvin of the Minnesota State Police detained George Floyd with that knee on his neck and George Floyd died, the world changed.
It has, but you know something? This is not about COVID-19 as well, because as horrific as that scene of the white police officer with the knee on George Floyd's neck, just days before that, as you pointed out, as some of your reporters pointed out, that privileged white woman in Central Park, Amy Cooper, calling the cops on an African-American male who was threatening to kill her, who of course was not doing that, which comes right after the jogger in Georgia who was killed by a former police officer and who took several months before the police even made an arrest. Add all that to the fact that COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting and crippling the African-American community. It's not, again, it's not just the cop's knee on George Floyd's neck. It's accumulation. And again, it goes back to, as you point out, it goes back to Stephen Clark. It goes back to Michael Brown in Ferguson. It goes back to Freddie Gray in Baltimore. This is not just a recent thing, and that's why the anger and frustration is so deep and so widespread.
Though, as a collective response across the country and now out into the rest of the world, many people are saying we actually have to go back to 1968 for such a time of strife and conflict and protest.
You know, that's I'm old enough to remember the riots that followed the assassination of Dr. King in 1968, as well as the riots in Detroit and Newark in 67. The difference here is that we didn't have a president who, first of all, the lack of a national leader calling for peace or unity is just startling, to see a lack of a voice coming from the White House. But at the same time, not only is there a lack of call for unity, they're talking about, he tweets something after the looting comes to shooting, talking about sicking police, vicious dogs on the demonstrators, talking about the liberal Democrat leaders, not Democratic, Democrat leaders of St. Paul and the cities around, and Sleepy Joe. The thought of the President of the United States, while the country is being split in two over police injustice as well as the ongoing virus, and the President just playing politics as he always has, it is just beyond startling. I don't even know what the word is anymore.
So I'm going to add to this the president talking to governors on a video teleconference. I don't know if you've just heard about this, with law enforcement and national security officials, saying local leaders have to get much tougher in the midst of these protests. And he said, here is the quote, "Most of you are weak. You have to arrest people." So he's calling on governors now for tougher crackdowns. We're going to hear from Governor Newsom at noon. I expect that in some way he'll address this. But what about the president in this space and the White House response beyond just this call on governors?
You know, I think back to the 92 riots that came in the aftermath of Rodney King, and I think of how President Bush try to sue the grieving nation. Our voices like that, could it be useful at this point? I don't know, but I still think of Bush trying to unite the country. I remember Mayor Lindsay of New York City, because I lived in New York City in 1968, Mayor Lindsay walking the streets with black leaders trying to hold the city together, and he did a good job, not throwing gasoline on the fire, not talking about with code words about shootings and vicious dogs and Democrat leaders who are failures. It is, you know, we're always, some people who follow politics and follow history always are tempted to associate an event with something that happened in the past. And there are lessons from the past, but we've never seen a president, as I said, pouring gasoline on the fire, not calling for unity, not calling for peace, but calling for retribution. And that's the most disheartening part.
Can I talk about the presumptive nominee in the presidential race right now and Joe Biden in this space? My main question, I guess, is there room for him to have more of a voice than he's taking? What's your opinion?
Oh, my God, this is the exact right time for Joe Biden. I mean, once upon a time, you look, I mean, I just remember the news, Bernie Sanders a few, I don't know if it was a month ago or 6 months ago, time doesn't make sense anymore, but he said, I have news to give, and all the cable networks flocked to him, and he said nothing. Given the fact that there has not been a voice of unity coming out for the White House, this would be the absolute ideal time for Joe Biden to come out from his bunker in Wilmington, Delaware, and just address the nation. Look, he will be the Democratic nominee for president. He has a very good shot of becoming the 46th president of the United States. This is the absolute opportunity for Joe Biden to say, look, I think the country is beyond hearing soothing words. We've heard soothing words after every police killing. I remember President Obama after the murders of the parishioners in Charleston, South Carolina. They all say the right words and they all say the right things, and maybe sometimes there's an effect of calmness. I don't know if anybody could bring calm, but Joe Biden cannot afford to be silent at this time. This is an absolute, a tragic opportunity, but an absolute opportunity for Joe Biden to stand up and point out the differences between his approach and the president's.
All right, I'm going to leave us with one more point here, and that is that as of about an hour ago, it looks like a record number of people in Montana have voted in the 2020 primary election. There are 2 days left to cast ballots, and it's Montana's first all-male election. Every voter was mailed a ballot, but one outcome of this could be record voter turnout across the country between now and November's Election Day.
There's something to be said about that, but there's also something to be said about the White House and President Trump's complete disdain for mail-in voting, talking about fraud, talking about cracking down on illegal votes, which, of course, there's none to be had. But so while there is encouraging news out of states like Montana with higher turnout, watch what how the government responds by curtailing, discouraging, and putting up barriers to increased voting participation.
You said the governor. You mean the president?
The president. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right, Ken. Thanks for checking in. I'm glad to know that everybody's safe there, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Beth. Your reporters are doing a fantastic job.
That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. He joins us the first Monday of every month from the Washington, D.C. area, law professor and director of the Capital Center for Law and Policy at the University of Pacific McGeorge School of Law. Leslie Jacobs is on the phone. Professor Jacobs, glad to have you with us today.
Happy to be here.
I want to explore the question of the president's power in limiting social media companies, Twitter in particular, as this battle has gone on and been moved into a different arena with Twitter putting some fact-checking links on messages.
Yes. Well, first off, he's issued this executive order, but no president has the power to go around changing law by executive order. So he's saying what he wants to have happen, not what actually will happen.
So at this point, does Twitter keep doing what it's doing and the president keeps speaking as if he has the power, or could this somehow end up in a court?
Well, yes, it could end up in a court if somebody starts doing something. And so, yes, Twitter can keep doing what it's doing because it's a private speaker and there's no law that tells it anything different. Section 230 is still in effect. And so really what the president's called upon is the Federal Communications Commission, which is an agency, by the way, an independent one, to write some rules interpreting this statute that Congress wrote. But first of all, there's limits there with what the FCC can write because it can only stay within the law. And the law provides very, very broad immunity to these Internet platforms. And so it's really up to Congress to change it if it's going to change.
So there was a directive to the Attorney General to establish a working group and to the Justice Department to investigate a list of behaviors. Are those consequential?
Well, I mean, the president can tell the Justice Department to do things. But once again, the Attorney General can decide whether to do those things, and the investigations are just investigations. The Attorney General can only enforce laws that exist, and so to be looking into things like unfair and deceptive acts, these platforms are allowed to do those things pretty much, or at least the way that they're described in Section 230, the immunity is so broad that it would be very difficult to prove that they're somehow doing something that otherwise breaks some other law.
Professor Jacobs, we have a lot of hot cases left to be decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, and this is the month with the deadline for those decisions. We'll have to talk in detail about them at another point in time, but would you leave us with a summary statement of what to watch for this month?
Well, we've got big cases coming up that haven't yet been decided. With a change in the court and a pretty strong conservative majority of five justices, we're not on pins and needles about a lot of the results. The one I would point to that we don't know what exactly will happen will be the one where we have three different entities, actually House committees and a New York grand jury, trying to seek the president's tax records. Okay, and so that's an interesting one because the law seems to say that he should have to disclose them, but of course we know all the politics involved, and it's unclear how the court will come out. So that's one to watch for. We also have things having to do with freedom of religion. We are waiting to hear about whether the federal employment statute protects gay or transgender people. We're waiting to hear about whether the president's order rescinding the DACA is going to be lawful. And we've got an abortion case we're waiting on, too, to see whether and how much the court will restrict further the scope of the abortion right.
All right. It's a to be continued, but thanks for your time today, Professor Jacobs.
Happy to be here.
It's Leslie Jacobs. She's a law professor and director of the Capital Center for Law and Policy at the University of Pacific McGeorge School of Law. Short break, and then we're back with two uplifts today. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.